ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
All right, let's to the first hour and our topic tonight, the crucial and hard-working organ, the liver. It's reddish-brown, it's tucked under your ribs, it's vital for performing a whole variety of jobs to keep you alive and healthy. It basically is the big cleaning organ of the body. It filters blood, it also stores energy, produces bile, regulates glucose, supports immunity, and a lot more. So tonight we'll delve into the common diseases that challenge liver health, like viral hepatitis, alcohol-related liver disease. That's topical for this time of the year, is it not? Cirrhosis and liver cancer. Also, things go really wrong. What's involved in liver transplantation, from wait lists to surgery and recovery. Joining us tonight is Professor Simone Strasser. Professor Strasser is a leading liver specialist and spokesperson for the Australian Liver Foundation. She has major clinical and research interests in primary liver cancer, viral hepatitis, fatty liver disease, and so on, a regular speaker, and is also a past president of the Gastroenterological Society of Australia. And she joins us here on Nightlife. Simone, good evening to you, and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I can talk for hours about the liver, and I've only got one.
We only do have one, don't we? Although this is about the only fact I know about it, other than that it's, you know,
well with the intro.
It is the only organ, I think, apart from the skin, which is a big organ, but no one really thinks of the skin as an organ anyway, which can regrow itself, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct, and it's amazing. So we actually can take out, and we do this for people that get, for instance, deposits of bowel cancer that might spread to the liver. They can have 2/3 of the liver removed and the rest of the liver will regenerate. And you can also, we don't do it so much in Australia, but overseas the standard of care, and I know we'll talk about liver transplant later, but the standard of care for liver transplant is donors who are actually alive. And an adult donor can donate 2/3 of their liver to a recipient and both of them will end up with a normal-sized liver. Yeah. It's amazing.
Hang on. How long does it take for you, if you give away 2/3 of your liver, come on, you can't be feeling that good after that, can you?
No. Well, we're pretty selective who we do it on, but, you know, people get through that surgery very well and they will regenerate their liver to a normal volume, normal size, by 2 to 3 months.
2 to 3 months?
Yep. It's pretty quick. So it's life saving, you know, it's life giving in the situation of transplantation, and it's life saving obviously for the person that gets it, and for someone who needs a major liver operation because they've got cancer in their liver, which would be the normal reason, they can have up to 2/3 of the liver removed and will regenerate the rest of their liver and go back to normal liver function. It's quite an extraordinary organ. The problem with it is that regenerative capacity, when there's an injury that just keeps on going and keeps on going, like you see with alcohol, or like you see if there's a virus infection or there's too much fat in the liver, which we see with fatty liver, that regeneration is a little bit counterproductive because it regenerates in little nodules that sort of occur all the way through the liver, little lumpy, bumpy bits, and that actually disturbs the function of the liver over time. So that's actually a regenerative process, but it's a counterproductive one.
Does your liver wear out as you get older?
Probably not. So for an individual person, they don't develop liver failure as they get older. The normal liver functions are there right through to the end. Having said that, we're a bit nervous about using a liver from someone who's very, very old and using it for transplant, although we have used liver donors who are in their 90s and they've worked perfectly well in putting them into, you know, somebody who's a recipient who's significantly younger than that. So for an individual, the liver doesn't wear out, but it probably doesn't regenerate quite as well, and we wouldn't do that major operation that I talked about to someone who's very old because we wouldn't expect their liver to repair itself back to the normal size.
Okay.
But it retains the functions that people need until they die of something else.
Yeah. It seems to be one of those organs that actually soldiers on. It doesn't seem accident prone or disease prone, does it? Some other organs are?
Yeah, there's a lot of diseases that can affect the liver. There's more than 100 different diseases, if not more, than it can affect it. And there are all sorts of things. There are viruses, there are autoimmune causes, the fatty liver I mentioned, from toxins such as alcohol. But it can regenerate. So, for instance, if someone has severe liver injury from alcohol and they've developed cirrhosis, and even if they've developed liver failure, they've turned yellow, they've developed fluid in the tummy, if they stop drinking and eat well and get themselves back healthy, that liver can actually regenerate and recover its function back to normal function. So it's quite extraordinary. You can come back from having liver failure from a cause. If you remove the cause, the liver will repair and return itself to normal function.
Hey.
Same if you remove viral hepatitis like hepatitis C or hepatitis B. If we treat those, the liver can go back to normal function. May not be normal structurally, and there may still be some risk of developing other things like cancer, but the function can return to normal and people don't have liver failure anymore.
How about that?
So, you know, that's amazing. And you know, I look at all of this as a really good story, and I see a lot of people. I'm a transplant specialist, so I see a lot of people who come to me thinking the end is nigh. Everybody has been really, really negative. If they don't get a transplant, they're going to die. It's the end of the world, all the rest of it. And I say, no, if you actually eat well, look after, have high protein, high energy, good, healthy, balanced diet, get rid of all the sugars and the ultra-processed stuff, get some regular exercise, stop drinking, look after your health and take the medications I prescribe, so some people need medications, the liver can actually repair itself to the point that people who thought they needed a transplant as their only option to survive will survive without a transplant.
You can fix it up. Hey, how about that?
So it's a really good story.
What's it do?
Oh, well, you highlighted it. So a lot of the things it does are that because it's a factory, it produces things, it produces energy to keep us going. So it turns glucose into glycogen, which is a storage of sugars. And then overnight when we're fasting and not eating, the glycogen will release glucose back.
Hang on, when you eat something, you're saying that the liver stores?
It stores that energy for when you need it later.
Stores it as glycogen.
As glycogen is the main storage. It also stores fat, and it's okay to store a little bit of fat. What happens in people with severe obesity or poorly controlled diabetes, though, is too much fat ends up in the liver, and it drives a whole lot of disease processes around the body, including inflammation around the body. So that's not necessarily a good storage function, but it stores a lot of our vitamins.
Mm.
So vitamins A and D and B12 are all stored in the liver. And it produces bile, and the bile is the stuff that gets secreted from the liver down the bile duct into your bowel and helps you digest your food. It also makes your poo turn brown. Right. So if it's blocked and not going through, your poo turns light brown color or very pale color. And it also produces the proteins that we need, particularly clotting factors. So what does that tell you? So when it's not working, what happens? Well, one thing, when it's as abruptly stops working, which we call acute liver failure, you can't regulate your glucose levels, and people's glucose levels or sugar levels will get very, very low to the point where they can get brain damage from that. Their bile will build up in their bloodstream and they'll turn yellow because it's not being excreted properly into the bowel anymore. This bowel notions will turn pale, the urine goes dark, the eyes will turn yellow. The clotting factors will be abnormal. They won't be normally produced and people will be prone to bleeding. And you build up ammonia because ammonia is a toxin in the body that's produced from a few different mechanisms, that the liver is the biggest organ that detoxifies and gets rid of ammonia. And if it's not there, not working properly, the ammonia builds up, goes to the brain and causes confusion and even coma. So we know what happens when it's not working well. We see it in the context of this acute liver failure I mentioned, where one day the liver's normal and the next day it's not because of something such as paracetamol would be the commonest from an overdose. Or in chronic liver failure, which is a long-term build-up of the cirrhosis we mentioned, where gradually over time liver function deteriorates and then usually something tips it over and the liver function deteriorates very, very suddenly and all those manifestations can happen. And the other manifestations are because the liver, as it builds up scar tissue, gets small, shrunken and hard, the normal blood flow can't flow through it properly and builds up. And then people develop these varicose veins that might happen in the food pipe. The esophagus can rupture and bleed, and that's a common way that people die who have got liver failure.
I've got this idea that it cleans things, that it cleans your...
It detoxifies. So all the medications that we take, foods that we take, even the bugs in the bowel, we all know, you know, we've heard about the bugs in the bowel. The liver is the sensing organism that extracts what we don't need in our bloodstream and takes them out and puts the good things back into the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a really important sensor sort of mechanism for sensing what's coming through from the bugs, from the drugs that we're ingesting, medications, from food. It hangs on to the things that we need, the building blocks, but it will detoxify and then excrete the things that we don't, and they all will come out in the bile as well.
Okay.
So a lot of things can go wrong when it's not working properly.
So Jennifer's texted in saying, hello, can we get rid of all the liver detox nonsense? I'm tired
please.
Of people talking about how beneficial doing a detox can be. Surely our livers are the best ever for detoxing. That's right, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I didn't ask Jennifer.
What are people going on about when they talk about detoxing your liver?
I didn't put Jennifer up to that one, but a woman after my heart. So there's a huge market in many, many things, but there's a huge market in these liver detoxes.
It's huge, I know, yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of money being made out of selling something that's a normal function that the liver does. So the liver detoxifies. That's what its job is. And the things that we need to do to help it do its work is to avoid things that harm it. And so the things that harm it are alcohol, which we mentioned,
mm-hmm.
some medications, particularly too much paracetamol in one go. It's our diet. So allowing it, what happens with obesity is the fat cells accumulate in the liver, poorly controlled diabetes. And then the other things that can harm it that we mentioned. But the things that people can do to help their own liver are stopping drinking, eating well, getting their weight down to a healthy weight range, exercising regularly. Mm. By eating well, avoiding too many sugars in the diet, too many carbs in the diet, that all promote weight gain. And you don't need to go and buy extra things to do that. You just need to be looking
at what's in these things you buy anyway?
Know. There's a whole range of things from various herbs and all sorts of different compounds that are in them. They're all different.
Mm.
And the other thing is that I've seen people take these liver detox things, liver cleansing things, and then go into liver failure and need an urgent liver transplant. So they can be dangerous as well.
Mm.
So firstly, they don't do any good. And secondly, they can be dangerous. It's rare, but it happens. And we see it with a whole lot of herbal and dietary supplements that they can cause liver failure in the wrong person.
Mm. Okay, why is booze bad for your liver? This is the most common thing, isn't it? I mean, people say, I had a big night on the booze and I've been doing some damage to my liver. Why is grog bad for the liver?
Because it has toxic metabolites that build up in the liver and they promote laying down of fat tissue and progression of scar tissue and inflammation in the liver. So the liver is very, very sensitive to alcohol, but there is a genetic component to it. So we know, and we've done big studies of looking at the genes across people, and this was a big study out of Australia and the US, looking at people's genes, and they examined a bunch of people who had a lot of alcohol intake, so high levels of alcohol intake, some of whom had severe liver disease and some didn't, and found that there were genetic determinants of that. So you can, and you know, and you hear these stories all the time, you know, why have I got liver failure when my mate at the pub drinks just as much as I do?
Yeah.
So some people are genetically predisposed to being more sensitive to alcohol, but most people who drink at a high level will get some level of alcohol damage in their liver, as they will in other organs, but more severe disease has probably got a genetic component. And it's also, we know with the liver that the more things you add to it to strain it, the more likely to get severe liver disease. Mm. So if somebody's got multiple metabolic risk factors, they've got high blood pressure, they've got obesity, they've got diabetes, particularly if they're getting older in age and they drink too much and they've got a virus, the chances are they're going to have cirrhosis and be at risk of liver failure and liver cancer. So taking away the things that we can fix easily, we can fix viruses easily. We've got fantastic treatments for viruses like hepatitis C and hepatitis B. We can take away alcohol by helping people with their alcohol dependency if they've got a significant dependency, and many people do, but we've got ways of helping manage that. And we can manage weight. We've got now good medications that can manage weight. We've got surgery that can manage weight. We've got lifestyle changes that can manage weight. So they're all really good stories because these are straightforward things we can do to help the liver repair itself against even significant damage and reduce the risk of needing a transplant or dying from liver failure or developing a liver cancer that might be fatal.
Mm. Professor Simone Strasser is our expert tonight, leading liver specialist. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Or you can text us questions as well if you like. But Give us a call and ask a question. 1-300-800-222, or you can text on 0467-922-702. Given humans have been consuming alcohol for thousands of years, Simone, how much is too much alcohol?
Well, the NHMRC has set a level that says above this level, you're putting yourself at harm from alcohol. And that level has been coming down over the years, and it's now no more than 10 standard drinks in a week and no more than 4 standard drinks in a single setting. So a standard drink is like glass of wine, not one of those big glasses. It's a midi of beer, not a schooner. It's a nip of spirits, not two. That's a standard drink. So that's about 10 grams of alcohol. So no more than 10 of those in a week and no more than 4 on an occasion. So that's the level that the NHMRC, by analysing global research, has come up with and says above this level, you're putting yourself at harm.
So above that, you may do yourself some damage, but not necessarily. But you may.
Well, there's different organs that can be affected. So alcohol is a driver of many different cancers. Can cause brain disease, heart disease, so multiple different diseases, and it's a cofactor. So as I mentioned before, if you're also living with obesity or you've got diabetes and you drink excessively, you're putting yourself at significant risk of liver disease. But alcohol in itself causes significant liver disease. Now, many people drink to excess, and we're seeing the age of people drinking to excess, particularly in women, has come down, which means that I'm seeing people with severe liver injury to the point that they've got liver failure and they're admitted to the hospital, to the intensive care unit in liver failure, in their 20s and 30s, where the only cause is alcohol. So this is a significant problem, and yet they can completely recover if they can get through that illness and they never drink again.
I, like many people, I'm sure, have regular checkups with the doc, and she always usually does a liver function test as part of the regime of things, and whenever it comes back fine, which it always has, I say, isn't that great? She said, yeah, but the thing is with liver function tests, they're always great until they're not.
So you don't
kind of get gradation. So you're either liver is tickety-boo until it's not. Is that the case?
Well, you get some clues. Some people have an ultrasound for another reason. It finds a bit of buildup of fat in the liver, which is actually a bit more sensitive than the liver tests. Mm-hmm. And the liver tests, and I've talked on radio before about this, the liver tests, the normal ranges that are reported on the liver tests are actually high. So because we know that a healthy liver test, and particularly a test called the ALT level, is 19 or lower in a woman and 30 or lower in a man, and yet the laboratories report them out, a normal range is significantly higher than that. So they might, depending on the laboratory, it might be 45 in a man reported as normal, but in fact under 30 is normal. So that accounts for the fact that one in three people live in Australia, one in three adults, is living with fatty liver disease due to weight or due to alcohol.
What's fatty liver disease? What's that?
So this is, and you didn't mention that in your introduction. You mentioned alcohol, you mentioned viruses. Yeah. But in fact, the commonest cause of liver disease in the community is something that we call metabolic dysfunction associated fatty liver disease. So that's a huge mouthful. Yeah. We call it MAFLD, MAFLD for short. Internationally, they've got another acronym.
Does it mean that your liver gets fatty, or what's the story?
It means your liver's got fatty. So your liver has built up fat, and the common causes of that are being overweight or obese, or having type 2 diabetes, or both. And some people don't have either of those risk factors, but they've got other features of metabolic dysfunction. So they've got high blood pressure, high cholesterol, their waist circumference is increased, and there's a few other parameters. So this is the commonest cause of liver disease, and it affects at least one in three Australian adults, and it's increasingly common in adolescents.
One in three?
No, one in three.
Oh, but this is because obesity is so widespread. Is that it?
Correct. Correct. And overweight is so widespread, so you don't have to have obesity to have it. And what's really scary is this fatty liver disease is now the commonest cause of needing a liver transplant in the United States. And it's heading that way in Australia as well, as we get now got good treatments for some of the other things that used to cause people to need transplants, such as hepatitis C. It's now driving more and more people needing a liver transplant from liver cancer and from liver failure. And it's becoming the leading cause.
Hello.
It's a fat. So if you're drinking a bit too much and you've got fatty liver because of those metabolic risk factors, you're more likely.
So,
but you can have liver cancer and liver failure from just fatty liver alone without being a drinker.
So these new weight loss drugs like Ozempic and so on, I mean, I'm told when we've done interviews about them, look, you know, they might have some deficits and side effects and so on, but the overall good they're doing by reducing your weight far outweigh these things generally. And you, well, what's your attitude towards them in relation to liver disease? Because it sounds as though if you're controlling obesity, you're improving your liver health, are you?
You're almost a liver specialist. Absolutely. So our biggest driver to manage this burden and ever-increasing burden of liver disease is to help people with weight control.
Mm.
And there are two ways of doing that. One is through, well, three ways. One is people can control what they're eating and their diet and get their weight down themselves, but that fails over time and most people will regain weight even if they do various diets and whatever to get it down or think they're making lifestyle changes. They will regain. Pharmacotherapy or medications to treat weight loss and treat obesity. So you mentioned one, that's a class of drugs called GLP-1 agonists, or semaglutide is the generic. That class of drugs has just been approved in the United States for the treatment of people with fatty liver disease.
Okay.
Not yet approved for that indication in Australia, but it's approved for obesity in Australia, and it's approved for diabetes
in Australia. It does seem to be some kind of wonder drug, this thing. I mean, I hate saying these things on air because I don't want to be promoting it, but it does sound as though, you know, like it has so many good effects, but most of them can in controlling obesity, which is responsible for so many deleterious health effects.
Yeah, and about half the benefit of it's from controlling the weight. The other is it's got some other specific impacts, probably on inflammation, because as you lose fat stores, you lose inflammation in the body. But there are positive trials, and I wasn't going to just talk about this in the clinical trial space, but there's clinical trials in liver disease, as I mentioned, in weight loss, but there's also clinical trials in kidney disease, in heart failure, in osteoarthritis, in psoriasis, all sorts of diseases that we know are related to obesity are being positively impacted by getting people's weight down through medications.
Okay.
They're not yet approved and they're approved for weight loss. They're not reimbursed and they've got a significant cost, but you save a lot on the food and on your health. So there are reasons for people to consider. The others, you know, that you have probably heard about bariatric surgery, weight loss surgery, not quite as reversible as stopping a medication, but it's got a significant role and it probably... And with all of these treatments, you need to be on them long term.
Yeah.
And surgery is something that stays away long term, although in some people can fail over time.
It can fail over
time. It's really a discussion. You know, anybody who's living with overweight or obesity and they really can't get their weight down are at risk of future complications.
Yeah.
And one of the earliest features can be fatty liver that can predate diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease and all the other things by 10 to 20 years.
Okay.
So the fatty liver is actually I talk about the canary in the coal mine. It might be the first sign that you're metabolically unhealthy, you're at risk of liver disease, but you're also at risk of all the other consequences such as diabetes and heart disease.
And you can test for fatty liver, can you?
Yeah, an ultrasound was pretty sensitive.
Does a blood test?
You will pick up abnormal liver tests in many people, but it's not as sensitive. But we know that, for instance, if someone's living with obesity and they've got diabetes, they've got over a 90% chance of having fatty liver.
Okay.
But they've got a 9 out of 10 chance of having it anyway. So we just so what we do is we actually, for every person that we think has fatty liver or know has fatty liver, the most important thing from my point of view as a liver specialist is assessing for how much scar tissue there is. And people should be asking their GP to ask them, what's the result of my Fib4? And what a Fib4 is, it's just based on somebody's age, two of their liver enzymes, which is their AST and ALT level, and a platelet count, which is all available on routine blood tests, can go into an online calculator. And we mentioned the Liver Foundation earlier. There is an online calculator on the website. Plug the four numbers in, age, AST, ALT, and platelet count, and you can find out what a Fib4 is. And then for anyone where it's under 1.3, they've got very low risk of having much liver disease. And if it's over 2.7, they've probably already got cirrhosis. And in between, we need to do another test to figure it out.
Okay.
But that was in a national consensus publication that we published in the Medical Journal of Australia a few months ago, earlier this year. to really to say to GPs, everybody with fatty liver should be assessed for this using a FIB4, and then you can decide who needs to go through and see a liver specialist and who doesn't. And if you don't, you still need to have all the management to prevent heart disease, diabetes, and all the other
things. All right, let's take some calls because plenty of people want to talk to you, and I can understand why. Margaret in Perth. Hello, Margaret.
Oh, good evening. I wanted to ask about the possibility of damage from hepatitis. My grandmother died of liver cancer and she wasn't a drinker. And my father also had a secondary, which was liver cancer, and he really wasn't a drinker either. So is there some... My grandmother originally came from Glasgow and probably from fairly poor circumstances. And I just wondered if the catching of hepatitis when she was younger had any influence. Hmm. She died at 53.
Yeah.
It's a good question, Margaret. I mean, we do need to distinguish between what we call primary liver cancer. So that's cancer that starts in the liver versus secondary liver cancer, which is cancer that's spread to the liver from somewhere else in the body, such as from bowel cancer. And they're very, very important and very, very different. So what I'm talking when we talk about liver cancer, I'm talking about primary liver cancer and particularly a form of liver cancer called hepatocellular carcinoma or HCC. And that arises in the liver and is in 90% of people have underlying liver disease. Now, there are different forms of viral hepatitis, as you ask. The common ones probably that someone who might have had hepatitis when they were young in Glasgow was probably hepatitis A, and that doesn't cause long-term liver disease and doesn't cause liver cancer. But we know the risk factors for people having hepatitis B and hepatitis C, which are either for hepatitis B, most people around the world got it at the time of birth. Their mother had hepatitis B. It was transmitted at the time of birth. And that's the commonest cause of liver cancer in Asia, for instance, comes from hepatitis B that people acquired at birth.
Okay.
Hepatitis C is usually from bloodborne virus. It's a bloodborne virus. It usually comes from injecting or other blood exposure. So, and they drive chronic liver disease. And up until recently, they've been the main drivers of primary liver cancer or HCC in Australia. But as we've had treatment, they're starting to drop and the non-viral causes are increasing. Now, I can't really say. It sounds like your dad had secondary liver cancer. I'm not sure what your grandma had, but if it was primary liver cancer and she wasn't a drinker, it could have been related to weight. Or back in those days, people weren't particularly overweight.
No, they weren't.
And it could have been viral hepatitis.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Margaret. As one of my callers, as my texters say, says, given the important role that these injectable drugs have on weight control, yet neither Mounjaro, which is tirzepatide, or Wegovy, which is semaglutide, for weight loss, are currently, and I mentioned the other brand name, Ozempic, are currently listed on the PBS for their weight management indications in Australia. This is insane. What do you think about that?
Well,
you don't have to. You don't have to line up with insane. But I mean, do you think there's a major
community need for health prevention to have access to these drugs on the PBS? Yes.
Okay.
No question. It's obviously a cost containment thing, but it's looking at short term costs and not looking at the long term benefits. And the fact that these drugs, which are going to be needed long term, can turn around liver disease, can turn around heart disease, kidney disease, stop people from dying at a premature age is really, really important. Mm. But the way our budgets go, we don't look at those long-term benefits of keeping people out of hospital and keeping people alive when we're looking at drug costs up front.
Dave?
Always,
Dave from Mossvale. G'day, Dave.
Yes. My son's got hemochromatosis.
Oh, yeah.
And first picked it up, he was, and I think these figures, I don't understand these figures, 4,000?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now, 2 months later, he's now up to 9,500. And he's getting all these giddy spells and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And they're draining his blood once a month. And the hospital says it has to be reduced to once a fortnight. Mm-hmm. Now,
Yep. So I didn't mention there are genetic causes of liver disease. And one of them is due to the buildup of iron within the liver or hemochromatosis. And to get full-blown hemochromatosis, you've got to have inherited two abnormal genes, one from mum, one from dad. So it's a genetic liver disease. Iron builds up. Once you know about it, you can get iron out of the body by removing blood frequently. So we know if we go to the blood bank too often and give donate blood, we'll get anemic. Well, what we want to do is actually remove blood to remove iron out of the body. So the 4,000, I'm guessing, was something called a ferritin level, and that's a marker of how much iron is in the body. And they're going to want to get it down to very low levels, under about 200, with removing blood. And they're finding that they haven't got any control at all by taking it once a month. They're going to up the ante and get it off once every two weeks, and it will eventually fall.
Yeah.
Is there any other way as well to help it, to reduce it?
Not in that condition. If people can tolerate having blood removed, that's the most efficient way. Now, some people have got iron overload because they've got excess turnover of blood and they actually need to have blood transfusions on a regular basis, and that's people living with thalassemia, and they build up iron as well, and they can't have blood removed because they're not making enough blood to start with and they're needing blood transfusions. So they go on a therapy that's called chelation that can actually bind the iron and remove it from the body, but it's not nearly as efficient as taking a pint of blood a month or every 2 weeks or whatever. Okay. So why we worry about hemochromatosis, it's most people, if they live with that level of iron, over time will develop liver scarring, liver cirrhosis and liver cancer. So and as well as other organ failures. So it doesn't just affect the liver.
So it's important.
Affect
the
heart.
It's important.
It's a very serious condition. We can screen for it now. If we know people have got it, we try and treat them early to remove the iron and not let it build up to that level. But some people don't present until they've had a lot of iron build up.
So donate blood, Dave?
No, but it's anything that he should not be eating.
We try and keep the iron in the diet down while we're trying to remove the iron. So a whole lot of red meat's got a whole lot of iron in it. So the doctors will have talked about trying to keep iron content in the food down. But the biggest thing is getting that iron out, which is going to be the blood, removing the blood, and doing that on a regular basis to keep that ferritin level nice and low. Okay. And then monitoring for complications. If scar tissue is already built up in the liver, then there's lifelong monitoring for liver cancer with an ultrasound and test.
All right, Dave. But in essence, once you're onto it, that's the main thing, isn't it, that you're onto it.
Yeah.
Does drinking a lot of water help your liver recover, says my texter?
No, not particularly. Okay. And in fact, in some people who have got more severe liver disease and got liver failure, drinking too much water can actually dilute the sodium level in the blood and cause a whole lot of problems. So nobody needs to drink huge amounts of water. And I do see people who think that drinking 3 or 4 litres of water a day is a good thing. It's probably too much. And certainly if you've got more severe liver disease, it's way too much because they'll dilute out their sodium and be at risk of seizures and all sorts of things.
All right.
So you've got to be careful. But you certainly need adequate fluid. You don't certainly
but not
need
too much.
But with most things.
Yeah. Tony from Adelaide. G'day, Tony.
G'day there. I just want to check and ask the person there, for people that may have a Gilbert's disease, what effect does that have on the liver over time?
Yeah, so Gilbert's, or it's also pronounced Gilbert in the French. So this is actually a good thing to have. So this is an enzyme deficiency that helps you actually remove the bilirubin, which is a component of your bile, out of the blood. So it can convert it and help you excrete it in the bile. And if you don't have that enzyme to help you excrete it, it can build up in the blood. But it doesn't get to dangerous levels. And there have been interesting studies, sort of big cohort or natural history type studies of people living with Gilbert's or Gilbert's actually are at reduced risk of heart disease and dying from heart disease. So, and there's no disease consequences of having it, but people know they've got it because when they have a blood test, their bilirubin level will be a bit high. And when we look at this type of bilirubin, it's something called unconjugated bilirubin because that enzyme hasn't done its job. And they just run with a high bilirubin level, but it's never dangerous. It can occasionally rarely impact how we clear some medications. But in general, for most people living with Gilbert's, they'll actually have a longer lifespan than if they didn't have it. So it's actually a good story. It's not a disease at all. It's just an enzyme defect that people are born with that doesn't have a disease consequence.
There you are, Tony. You're in the clear.
All right. Thank you.
You're good.
Yeah. You have Gilbert's, I would say. Yeah. See ya. So it sounds sort of sounds a bit classier, doesn't it?
It's much more classy than Gilbert.
Michael from Kenthurst. G'day, Michael.
Hello.
Hello. What's you? What's up, Michael?
I'm thank you for your program. The my wife is suffering from amyloids, and I believe it's a protein that gets developed in the liver. And in her case, it's traveled to her heart. It's the ATTR, the wild type. And I'm just wondering, why does it develop in the liver? What's going on there?
Well, again, it's a disease process where your production of this amyloid has gone wrong, but it's a disorder that affects the whole body. And you can accumulate this abnormal protein or amyloid in the liver, so the liver gets very swollen and its function deteriorates. It accumulates in the heart, as you mentioned, in the kidneys, all through the body. And it's in some people it's part of a malignant process. In other people, it's part of an inflammatory process. And in some people, they just make too much of it and we don't really understand why. But it's not a liver disease per se. It's a disease that affects the whole body. It's just the liver is implicated in it.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Quite a few people were saying, does taking milk thistle help repair the liver? I don't know what this is.
Oh, milk thistle or silymarin, it's one of the health tonics that people can buy to help their liver. Probably doesn't have any harms. Interestingly, we use it in high dose, and this is very topical this year, for mushroom poisoning.
Oh,
so people who have had severe poisoning from Amanita phylloides death cap mushroom, it's an antidote in that situation. And it's been studied, we've even studied it in people with hepatitis C back in many years ago. It's an interesting compound. It might have some benefit. It certainly doesn't have harm.
Right.
And if somebody wants to take milk thistle, I don't stop them. It's not very expensive. They're not wasting a whole lot of pennies on it.
Right.
So it's okay to take it. Do I prescribe it? No. There's no good evidence for a benefit. There's a lot of other things that we can do that have got much better evidence. But if people feel strongly they want to take it, I don't stop them.
Okay. My text says, with the exception of thoracic and sleep physicians, most doctors rarely emphasise how crucial regular high-quality sleep is for maintaining optimal liver function. Well, good sleep's very important for overall well-being. Is it particularly important for your liver, Simone?
I think it's important for overall well-being and liver's part of that. And, you know, it's important for regulating glucose levels, for mental health reasons, for a whole lot of reasons. And there's so much interplay between everything that we do that can affect the liver. Mental health and liver disease coexist. Poor sleep leading to anxiety, depression, people want to drink too much, take extra drugs, recreational drugs, whatever, all of which can harm the liver. So it's all quite complex. And I think for everybody, having a good exercise regimen, a good sleep pattern and a good diet are essential to their overall well-being.
Okay. In short, what should you be doing to look after your or in keeping your liver healthy? Or is it the same thing you should be doing for the rest of yourself? That is, you know, eating properly, exercising properly, getting good sleep.
Well, it's all of that. So we're now recognizing that none of these diseases of lifestyle exist on their own, and yet, you know, the way medical care is provided, the GP sort of looks at everything, but then they send you off to a diabetes specialist who just looks after the diabetes, or an obesity specialist, or a respiratory specialist, this was mentioned, about your sleep apnea, or a heart specialist about your heart failure, or me for your liver, and everything's sort of siloed off because of the specialist that you're seeing. But in fact, it's the same disease affecting all those organs, and that's a disease of excess,
right?
The way we eat, ultra-processed foods, not getting enough protein in our diet, eating too many calories, eating all day, having snacks, you know, getting up at night, snacking all night, having poor sleep, drinking too much alcohol, all contributes to many of those diseases. And so the management approach for these lifestyle diseases is going to be the same message. It's, you know, look at your diet, cut down the carbohydrates particularly. That's the bread, pasta, potatoes, rice, which can be a significant proportion of people's food. It's a takeaway, ultra-processed foods, fast foods. Sugary soft drinks are a complete disaster. So these are all things that I spend, as a liver specialist, much of every consult talking about how to get those things out of your diet, focus on quality foods, quality vegetables, fruit, lean meats and fish particularly, and plenty of exercise, which helps your diabetes, your obesity and your liver disease, regardless of if you've got other causes for liver disease as well. It's important to maintain all those other things and treat the other causes as well.
Mark from Oak Park. G'day, Mark.
Yeah, hi. Good evening, Phil, and good evening, G'day. Simone. I have recovered from, I used to be a Hep C positive, and I recovered from that 25 years ago now, probably, when the medications first came in. And I was just wondering, I used to donate blood prior to that, and I probably before the blood testing used to take into account everything that all the bad things going around in my bloodstream, but they're a lot cleaner now, and I'm just wondering if I'm likely to ever be able to give blood again.
So it's a really good question. So you've been cured of your hepatitis C, and back if it was that long ago, it was probably with the interferon-based treatment, but for the last almost 10 years, we've been using tablets to treat hepatitis C, and they're 99% effective. So just about everybody who has a diagnosis of hep C gets a medication, it clears it, it's cured. You can get it again if you're reinfected, but it's cured. But the antibody stays in the blood long-term. So lifelong. So if you have another antibody test at any time, even 25 years after you've cleared your hepatitis C, the antibody will still be showing you've had prior exposure. And the blood bank has to keep our blood supply 100% safe. So they will screen on an antibody, and if you pick up on an antibody, they won't let you be a blood donor. So, you don't have hepatitis C, you can't transmit it to anybody, and yes, but theoretically you could be a blood donor, but they set that bar so high to keep the blood supply as safe as possible. You can be an organ donor. So we, in fact, many of our organ donors have either had a prior exposure to hepatitis C or currently have hepatitis C, but we've got such fantastic treatments, we just get rid of it after we do an organ transplant. It doesn't, it's not a barrier to organ transplant, but it is a barrier to blood donation.
Yeah. Okay.
That's fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. My guest is Professor Simone Strasser. Simone is a leading liver specialist, spokesperson for the Australian Liver Foundation as well. Liver transplants, are they easy to do? Sorry, that's a ridiculous question. Of course they're not, but I mean, are they relatively straightforward and are they very successful?
Straightforward, no. They're complex major surgery.
Surgery, of course.
In our unit in New South Wales, we do about between 80 and 90 adult liver transplants a year. And at the Children's Hospital, which we work with closely, they do 20 to 25 children who need liver transplants per year. And it is rising each year. We have a waiting list for people who have been assessed, who need transplant, suitable for transplant, and they're on a waiting list. And our donors are people who have died in an intensive care unit, usually from severe brain injury leading to brain death. That's most of our donors. And the surgery itself, we've got a team of unbelievably fantastic surgeons and anaesthetists and all the team that they work with, their nursing assistants and everybody else who's in the operating theatre. And they can take as short as maybe 4 hours to do a very, very straightforward transplant to 16 hours if it's a really complicated one.
Yeah,
right. Where there's a lot of bleeding and a lot of difficulty, particularly if somebody's had a transplant before and everything's a bit stuck there and it takes a long time to undo all that stickiness. And then we've got to support all the organs through the operation itself, but then there's another at least 3 days in the intensive care unit recovering and then another couple of weeks in the hospital recovering and then lifelong care to keep that liver healthy. So it can be very, very complex surgery. We don't take people into it unless we think we can take them out of it at the other end. So our survival at 1 year is 90 to 95% in a group of people who would otherwise have probably died in that time period. So we accept the fact that there's a 5 to 10% risk, early risk. And then by 5 years, about 85% of people are still alive and going well after their transplant. So it's a very successful life-transforming operation that we're delighted to perform on the right people and give them back that longevity and quality of life.
Robin says, is dandelion tea good for your liver?
Absolutely no idea. Probably not harmful.
Anne says, can eating 4 pieces of fruit daily affect your liver?
Yeah, there's probably too much sugar in 4 pieces of fruit. Okay. So I actually say, if people trying to lose weight and control sugars and control fatty liver, maximum 2 pieces of fruit a day is probably enough for all the vitamins and the fiber that you need. But over that, you're getting quite a bit of extra sugar that turns into fat in the liver.
Mm.
So don't overdo the fruit. Some people have a real sweet tooth and they don't want the, you know, they know not to have the soft drinks but or the cordials, but then they'll go for the fruit, and you can overdo it on the fruit as well.
Greg from the Central Coast. G'day, Greg.
Good evening. Yeah. You were speaking on earlier this evening, you were speaking on B12.
Vitamin B12, yeah.
Exactly. And I lose B12, and I've actually got to go for another shot of B12.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why I continually lose B12.
Well, it's not related to liver disease. It's related to absorption in the gut. So there's lots of causes for B12 deficiency, but it's usually to do with absorption. And the liver just happens to be where it's stored. So you'll deplete your liver of B12 if you're not absorbing it or you're losing it.
Mm, okay.
But it's not a liver problem per se.
You wanted to talk about a free telephone service connecting people with a liver nurse specialist too.
Absolutely. So we're very, very fortunate, and this is with the Liver Foundation, to have been funded by the federal government as part of the National Cancer Strategy to have an absolutely free nurse-led support line for people who are concerned of or have liver cancer, or their carers or loved ones,
mm-hmm.
or even their healthcare professionals if they need some extra advice. And we've got a team of very, very experienced liver nurses that have worked in liver transplant units and liver failure units and liver clinics around the country, who are there every day, Monday to Friday, providing free advice to people. And so they can go on the Liver Foundation website, which is at liver.org.au, and find the free 1-800 number. Their health practitioner can actually register them for a phone call as well, and they'll have an amazing conversation with our liver nurse to answer their liver questions. Now, they're not providing individual care to an individual person, but they can answer general questions about liver health, liver disease, liver cancer in particular, because it's around liver cancer support, and liver transplant, because that's a key treatment. About a quarter to a third of liver transplants in Australia are done for small liver cancers,
mm.
so it's a pathway to transplant as well. So that nurse-led support line is a fantastic support for anybody who is concerned or living with cancer, to provide that extra information above what their normal healthcare team is providing. And we're finding it's particularly useful for people living in regional and remote Australia, where they may not have a regular liver specialist that they can see on a regular basis, and provides that extra level of support to them.
Mm. All right, briefly, to sum up, to look after your liver, you should be eating a good, healthy, fresh food and vegetable diet, not too much sugar, not too much fat, obviously, and lay off the grog.
And plenty of protein in your diet. You do need protein to maintain muscle. And one of the big things with liver disease is not let your muscles go.
Okay.
So you've got to maintain muscle, and we didn't talk enough about that.
Simone, it's been terrific talking with you. It's a big topic, as you've made perfectly plain. All right. And that's an interesting question about those weight loss drugs, and there's a whole lot of health policy and decisions to be made about all that too, I agree. Tremendous to have your expertise and time, and I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Philip. It's been wonderful.
Professor Simone Strass, leading liver specialist and spokesperson for the Australian Liver Foundation, has been our guest tonight.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.